A New York City institution turns 100 this month. For a century now, the subway has rumbled, roared, and sputtered under the sidewalks of New York. If you lived in an American city with a public rail system, odds are you're riding the legacy of the subway. But if you grew up in New York, or lived there for a while, or even just visited, you know that this subway is something else. It's the city's most unifying institution, a badge of identity, a place of legend, and sometimes nightmare. Today on Talk of the Nation, the history and mythology of the New York City subway. We want to hear your stories about the New York subway, the strangest things you've seen there, the experience you can't forget, the smell you couldn't identify. If you've ever clung to the straps or roamed the tunnels, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'll share my story, so you better be prepared to share yours. Our first guest is Lorraine Diehl, author of Subways, The Tracks That Built New York City, and she joins us appropriately enough from NPR's New York Bureau, just a few blocks from Grand Central Station, where, in case you weren't aware of it, you can catch the 4, 5, 6, and 7 trains, and, of course, the shuttle to Times Square. Welcome, Lorraine Diehl.
Thank you very much. It's funny, you call it the 4, 5, and 6. I grew up calling it the Lexington Avenue, and my daughter and I are always battling about this. I say, I'm taking the Lexington Avenue train, and she says, you mean the 4, 5, and 6? I said, I don't know if that's what I mean.
Lorraine, I'm not even going to pursue what that says about the age difference. I mean, for all I know, you remember when telephone numbers in New York were Trafalgar 5 and Susquehanna 7.
I had one.
I knew. I was taking a guess there. It was just a chance. Well, anyway, So yes, the Lexington Avenue line, of course, and Yankee fans will know that the 4 is the one you stay on to get up to 161st Street and Woodlawn Road. Is that 164? Oh, I got my map here. We can double check. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show. You know, I'm going to start right at the beginning here by undermining our 100-year anniversary theme and say that actually there was another subway that made its appearance almost 35 years before the one we're celebrating. So tell us about that subway.
You're talking about the secret subway.
The secret subway. I love that. Why was it? What was it?
It's extraordinary because just picture this. Someone literally built a subway in New York City in secret, and no one knew about it. It's an extraordinary story. What happened is in 1868, Alfred Eli Beach, who was editor of the New York Sun, was looking out his window, and he realized what was obvious to everyone. The city was jam-packed with people. There was no way to cross the street. Most of the population was below 14th Street. It was just a mess, and he thought we should have a subway. Well, the one thing he could not overcome was Boss Tweed, who had a vital interest in the trolley lines. So he decided, I'll show him. I'm going to build a subway in secret.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, what he did is he literally rented out Devlin's Clothing Store on the corner of Warren Street and Broadway, just across from City Hall, which is marvelous, right under the nose of Boss Tweed. And he literally had workers come in at night and dig 21 feet underneath the basement of Devlin's, just one city block from Warren Street to Murray Street. And every single night for 2 years, these guys would come in, they would dig the tunnel, they would take the debris and dump it in the Hudson River. And what he did when he finally finished it, he had built a waiting room that was this sort of Phantom of the Opera extravaganza. It had a chandelier. It had fish tanks. It had beautiful oil paintings on the wall. It had gas lamps with beautiful statues of Mercury. And then he had one single car. Now, how he did this is he did it by a giant fan. There was a blower attached to this fan, and the fan would literally blow that one car one city block and then suck it back again.
So more like those tubes that you have in the old department stores, the pneumatic.
Yes, in fact, it's the same prototype. later on, and no one, I can't even get my head around this one, but we had that system, a whole new pneumatic system, underneath the streets of New York for the New York Post Office up until the 1950s.
Wow.
They actually shot mail, rocketeers shot mail underneath the city in that same principle, that sort of, you know, whoosh with the fan.
So that subway was one block long. It didn't actually ever grow beyond that one block, did it?
Didn't grow, and he didn't expect it to. I mean, he did have visions of grandeur. He thought, we can go to Central Park, but in fact, he realized, well, his real purpose was to show that it could be done, that it should be done, and he felt that once people saw it, Boss Tweed would not be able to say or do anything, and that was the idea.
And was he right? I mean, and so 30 years later, there was a city operated plan or city plan to build these new tracks.
That's
that
right.
Ran up and down.
That ran up and down Manhattan in 1904, of course, as you know, is the 100th anniversary of it. August Belmont, the financier, is the man who literally underwrote what was then the city subway system, which was the IRT. And the first subway stop is one that is closed to the public now, although I think it's going to be opened for the ceremonies. It's the original City Hall stop, and it's absolutely exquisite. But one of the things that they got from Beach and they understood is, if you want people to go down in a hole in the ground, you have to make it pretty down there and you have to make it safe down there. So in order to assure people that they'd want to be there, he spent an awful lot of money, especially on the City Hall stop, because that was the flagship stop. He had Gustavino tiles. He had beautiful mosaics. It was an absolutely beautiful station, and hopefully they're going to buff it up a bit enough so that you'll be able to at least see what we can no longer use.
Now, do trains still roll through that station, or is it off? So what line? Now I'm curious, because
I should confess that
I'm also I think some friends of mine and I calculated that we had spent 3,000 trips on the train going back and forth to school while we were growing up. So that's how I got to school when I was a youth.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, because I also grew up near a station that was closed, the 91st Street station,
right,
on the Broadway line. But where,
yes,
is the City Hall? What line was the City
Hall
station?
I'll tell you how to get there.
Okay.
It's the Lexington Avenue IRT.
Uh-huh.
You have to bear with my ancient vernacular.
Okay.
But you take the local, the Lexington Avenue local to supposedly the last stop, which is the City Hall stop, Brooklyn Bridge stop. That's where you usually have to get off the train, and then you have to take the express right across the platform, because that continues on down to the tip of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stay on that train, what it does is it loops around, and then it comes uptown. That's the one that you would be taking if you were at the City Hall stop and going uptown. As it's looping around, the old City Hall station. So you actually get a glimpse of it. And if you stay in the front of the train, and if you're lucky enough to have a train with a window, and if you're super lucky to have a very nice motorman who appreciates your enthusiasm, you really get, it's really like Phantom of the Opera, because it's dark and musty, and yet you can see what had been there. It's really rather interesting.
So tell us just a little bit. The initial line ran up and down the west side of Manhattan. Is that right?
Started off at City Hall, uh-huh, got up to 42nd Street, veered west, and then went up. Then it became what is now the Broadway IRT.
Uh-huh.
It went up to 145th Street on the west side of Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
That was the initial ride. And what was so wonderful about that is the first day, Mayor McClellan, when he declared the station open, declared the subway open, and the whole city was so excited. Well, he became a total child. He got in the motorman's cab, and he was supposed to just sort of do this ceremonial little tug of the brake. Well, he decided he wanted to run the train, and he ran the train halfway up Manhattan. And apparently, I don't know, this story may be apocryphal, but he was putting on a lot of speed, and the motorman was just gasping and saying, you know, Mayor, you've just got to let me handle this train. And he was like a little kid with a toy. He didn't want to let it go.
So are they still building subway lines, or is that finished?
No, the Second Avenue subway is going to be built. I don't know. I don't know exactly when. I know that it's definitely underway now, and I think they're scoping out where on the east side they're going to be making stops, and of course they have to condemn buildings and stuff like that. So it's a big deal. But that was an original plan that kept being shoved aside, and now it seems we're going to have a Second Avenue subway.
Okay.
I don't know when, but we will.
But we've been hearing that for a while, so we'll wait and
this
see.
This is true. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's
see if we can take some of your calls now. Our number is 800-989-TALK, and let's go to. Well, here, this is always interesting. Paul in Honolulu, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I grew up in Yonkers, New York, and I won't tell you my age, but when I was a kid, I used to take the trolley to the 242nd Street Van Cortlandt Park station, and I used to take a subway downtown for 5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And my friend Ronnie and I, when we were 7 or 8 years old, used to, and I don't remember exactly how we got there, but we used to go down to the pole. I guess we, guessing it was the 242nd Street subway, too. We used to go down to the Polo Grounds, the old place where the New York Giants played. Mm-hmm. We used to get a ticket in April when the season began for the Labor Day doubleheader, and then we take the subway down on Labor Day to see that. Those two ball games for $1.75 for grandstand seats.
That's so fascinating. Well, you mentioned the nickel. One of the things that's so fascinating about the system is it was a nickel in 1904 when the subway opened, and the nickel fare stayed in place until 1947.
Okay, and yeah, this was probably around 1945 or 46.
Yeah, because that's amazing, isn't it, that you could you just paid one nickel and you could travel all around the city on that one nickel.
That's true, and the funny thing is every so often you used to see someone jump over the turnstiles.
Yeah. Imagine that.
Well, a nickel doesn't mean as much then as it does today, or something like that. Paul,
anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Let's go to Lawrence in New York City. Welcome to the program, Lawrence.
Well, hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. I am the producer of a show called The A-Train Plays, which actually takes place on the New York City subway system.
No fooling. Mm-hmm. And how does the play go?
Well, what happens is we're actually doing a show at the end of October, and what happens is 6 playwrights will meet me at the 207th Street and Broadway station with no idea who the characters or how many characters they will have in their play. And they will stick their hand into a bag, pull a number out, and that's how many characters, and then stick their hand into another bag and pull the headshots of the performers, and those are the characters. And they have the amount of time it takes to go from 207th Street and Broadway to Far Rockaway, which takes about an hour and 45 minutes to write a 15-minute one-act play.
That's wild.
When they get down there, they meet their directors, and everybody travels back to 207th Street, then moves on to 59th Street. We meet the performers, we copy the scripts, we learn the script, and within 24 hours we put the show up fully produced off book.
Go ahead, Lorraine.
That sounds a little familiar to me.
We've actually been doing it for about 3 years, and we have had a little bit of attention, thank God. And we always do it at the Neighborhood Playhouse School here in Manhattan, and it's a benefit for the school.
Uh-huh.
And we also do musicals. So what happens with that is the same format for the writers, but when they get to Far Rockaway, they do a blind draw of who their lyricist composer is going to be. And then the lyricist composers have the amount of time to travel back to 207th Street to write 2 songs for the 15-minute musical that was written.
Speaking of pressure.
Yeah, well, we like the pressure. It's kind of fun.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Lawrence, for that call. Lorraine, we only got about a few seconds left.
Sure.
If you had to go on one line on the New York subway, what would it be?
One line in the New York subway. Well, of course, my favorite, as I said, is the IRT, because I'll do anything to take a ride around that old City Hall station. So whenever I get down there, I give myself a few extra minutes so that I can just take that loop and see the City Hall station, because it's really a part of our past and a very, very lovely part of it, too.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Lorraine Diehl is the author of the new book, Subways, The Tracks That Build New York City. She joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. We're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the New York Subway. We want to hear your stories. Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about the New York City subway. It's 100 years old this month, almost since the beginning. The subway has been celebrated in song, written into novels, and served as a backdrop, and sometimes as a punchline, in countless movies. like this scene from Men in Black 2, where Will Smith's secret agent character narrowly saves a trainload of blasé New Yorkers from a ravenous alien, and then he must replace their memory of it with a plausible cover story.
May I have your attention, please? The city of New York would like to thank you for participating in our drill. Had this been an actual emergency, y'all would have been eaten. 'Cause you don't listen. You're ignorant. How a man gonna come bashing through the back of a subway when... That's the problem with all y'all New Yorkers.
Oh, we've seen it all.
Oh, no, a 600-foot worm. Save us, Mr. Black Man.
Now, I come in, I ask you nice, move to the next car. Y'all just sit there like... Thank you for participating in our drill. Hopefully you enjoyed our new, smaller, more energy-efficient subway cars. Watch your step. You will have a nice evening.
So even if your stories of the subway don't include alien attacks, or especially if they do include alien attacks, we want to hear from you. Call us with your best subway story at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're joined now from the New York Bureau by Randy Kennedy, who for 3 years wrote the New York Times Tunnel Vision column. They're collected in the new book, Subway Land, Adventures in the World Beneath New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So which line did you ride in the morning?
The line I still ride in the morning is the Q train. Well, I get on the R, but then I switch to the Q train that goes across the Manhattan Bridge.
Okay, well, I've got my subway map here. So yeah. The Q train, did that have another name once?
Oh, wait, I've lost track now because I think that the Manhattan Bridge was sort of rehabilitated, and so before that the lines were a completely different configuration. And I think that maybe in parts in Brooklyn the Q used to be the D, or maybe it was the, I'm sort of map challenged, so I can't remember this sort of stuff. Well, but I think it was another letter.
Okay, I won't push that too hard. How long a ride is it for you each day?
If I hit the transfers perfectly, I can go door to door from Park Slope, Brooklyn, to Times Square in about half an hour. And if I don't hit it perfectly, it's anywhere from 45 minutes to 50 minutes, something like that. But it's a gorgeous ride because you're going across the bridge and you can look out and see the Manhattan Bridge across from you, and then past that in the harbor, you can see the Statue of Liberty and you can see the skyline of Lower Manhattan, and it's. On a beautiful day like this, it's just as fantastic.
Well, let me ask you, the majority of the subway system is, of course, underground.
Right, about half of it.
Is it just half? Because
it works out to about half and half.
Okay. I just was wondering, it's a little hard to get your soul soaring as when you go through a dark tunnel, but those moments where you pop out into the light, especially at the Manhattan Bridge or something, that's really something.
They're fantastic. And the only downside now is that when you pop out into the light, what also pops out are people's cell phones because they can suddenly get reception. And so in the morning, as soon as you hit, before you hit daylight, in fact, people have got the phones out with the numbers ready to go. And then as soon as you hit daylight, they start calling. Or, and I'm not sure how people time it this way, but, as soon as the train comes out of the tunnel, people's phones start ringing. It's like somebody's calling them and saying, okay, I know they're going to be coming out right now.
Well,
ring, hello. I don't know how it works.
It must be the global positioning satellite, which gets a bead on them or something
like that. Yeah, they have special cell phones, I guess.
So one of the things that that I mentioned and you talk quite a bit in your columns about is this subway is being an important place for holding New York City together. It really is in a way that, I don't know, maybe there are other transit systems that do that, but certainly not, it's harder to have that community sense when you're stuck in your car anyway.
Right. And sometimes I feel it's a little corny to say this, but I do think in large part it's true that, more of us here, even when you're looking at Chicago or Boston, more of us here have to use the subway, and we do use the subway every day to get to work. So every day you're locked in this little metal room with a bunch of people, you don't know. And a lot of people you might never have any of that sort of proximity with in the rest of your life. And you don't maybe make eye contact or smile or talk to each other, but there's something about that proximity, I think, and about the fact that when a subway gets stuck or, you can't understand the announcements, you're all sort of united in your hatred or your frustration. I do think that makes the city more cohesive than a city where everybody's locked up in their cars, you know, with the radio turned up,
right?
You know, zooming through a neighborhood at 70 miles an hour.
The other moment that's very satisfying, or in some ways, I think, is coming back from a baseball game, Shea Stadium, where you know, everybody's just seen the game, and you have like a,
yeah.
It's like being in a bar. You can talk to all the people that you just watched the game with.
It's the perfect icebreaker. In fact, it's funny, this column, the Subway column, started during the 2000 Subway series. And the idea was just to, you know, go sort of capture the essence of the, you know, the fans on the number 7 train or, you know, or going to Yankee Stadium too. And it was great because, it was hard as a reporter to talk to people in the subway because they're in a hurry. It's crowded. It's loud. It's like every possible condition you could think of for making it a horrible experience for a reporter, you know, is in place down there. But when you're right. When you're with fans after a game, you know, it's just like it's like a big rolling party.
Let's take some of your calls. Let's go to Tom in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is there some kind of correlation? I'm calling from Cleveland, and my wife and I, we travel extensively. It seems that every city we go to has a subway system, seems to do very well economically. There's people downtown. There's things to do, shopping, restaurants. But Cleveland doesn't have anything like that. We have a rapid line. Of course, as you know, recently Cleveland was like the poorest city in the country. So I wonder if anyone knows if there's some kind of correlation between subways and economic vitality of the city. And I'll take my answer off the air here.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
I think maybe some of that is incidental because I think that in cities where there's this very dense urban core, you're going to have a subway because somebody realized fairly early on that they weren't. That was going to be the best way to get people around. So I don't know. Maybe that has something to do with the correlation between there being a subway and a city being sort of more vibrant economically.
All right. Let's try Trish in Oakland, California. Trish, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Okay. You're here. What's your question?
Well, actually, it's a story. I met my husband on the subway.
No.
I did. In 1978, we were on the A train. We met up at the bridge station coming from New Jersey, where I worked and where his mother lived. And he had just come back from Japan, and we met on the subway, and as we transferred at 59th Street, he asked for my phone number.
Oh, that's great.
So wait a minute.
Of course, between I gave him my work number, of course, not my home number.
but between 168th and 59th, you were able to get enough of a rapport going to exchange telephone numbers?
Yeah, well, he'd been living in Japan, and he had some things with him that were related to Japan, and I'd been to Japan as a kid, so we started talking about Japan.
Hmm.
That's great.
Thanks.
But,
when
we went to transfer, I started up the steps, and he said, can I have your phone number? And I said, I kind of stopped, and he said, if I don't get your number, I'll probably never see you again. And that was true, and I gave him my number, and we got married. It's been 24 years we've been married now.
Well done, Trish. Thanks for the call. But you've seen that happen before, haven't you, Randy Kennedy?
Yeah, there's a column in the book about a couple who met on the F train, and the circumstances were actually a little more tragic than that, because the woman who eventually got married was standing on the platform, and a guy standing near her tried to commit suicide by jumping in front of the train, and he was gravely injured, although he didn't die. And a man who had seen her on the platform several times and thought that she was cute ran up to help her. They got to know each other, and they're married now.
Cool. I have an email here from Stuart Clipper, who writes, my main point here is me. I only exist because of the subway. Somewhere deep in the heart of Brooklyn back in the mid-30s, a flirtation occurred between my mom and dad, not then such, and about 8 years later, my existence became manifest. So there we have it. Let's take one more call. Jessica in Sacramento, California. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your question? You're on the air.
I don't have a question. I have a story.
Oh, let's hear your story.
Well, my brother moved to New York City in the early 80s, and he was working at the Watchtower headquarters. And we had sent him 12 helium balloons on his year anniversary of living there. And so we're transporting these on the subway, trying to look inconspicuous, a dozen helium balloons. And this guy comes down the train looking very angry and ready to explode. And he says, I hate balloons. and we wanted to just pop them and disappear. But we made it safely, and the balloons were all intact.
Well, that's a good story, too. Jessica, thanks very much for that.
You're welcome.
Okay. You know, until the mid-1970s, riding the New York City subway held a certain extra attraction for those who like such things, a charming smile of Miss Subways shining down from posters and placards. Young women competed in this beauty contest for more than 30 years, and the contest became a part of New York City lore. Gene Kelly even fell in love with one of them, or rather with her silver screen counterpart, Miss Turnstiles, in the movie On the Town.
Hey, what are you doing?
Putting up a little artwork. There. Miss Turnstiles for the month of June.
Huh?
Meet lovely Ivy Smith.
Gee, a real New York glamour girl. A debutante, I'll bet.
She must be pretty important.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
What do you mean? Her picture's up all over the subway.
Well, like it says, they pick a new Miss Turnstiles every month.
Now, the Metropolitan Transit Authority and the New York Post have revived the tradition. There are currently four women who've made the cut as finalists in the rechristened Ms. Subways contest: Karen Allison Bob, Elaine Chan, Carrie Kent Smith, and Caroline Sanchez Bernat. Carrie and Caroline join us from Manhattan. Thanks, both of you, for joining us.
Hi.
And I guess I should first of all ask you, Caroline Sanchez Bernat, what line do you ride to work?
I ride the A train or the C train to work, whichever comes first.
So you're lucky. You've got a choice. And Carrie Kent Smith, what about you?
I take the N and the R.
I see. So, Ms. Smith, how did you get involved in this contest?
Well, mine is deep-rooted. My mother was Miss Subways 1967, and back then my grandmother had sent her picture in unbeknownst to my mother, and she wound up becoming a finalist. And so she was chosen, actually, to have her picture represent the entire decade of the 60s during this whole centennial celebration for the subways. And because of that, she found out that they were revamping this contest, and she had said, I can either do what your grandmother did to me, or you can be a part of it. So I decided to help facilitate that process, and here I am.
Really? Is it a fun thing to compete in? What do you have to do?
Well, I mean, we sent pictures in, and then we answered some questions, and, you know, that was definitely thought-provoking. And since it's hit, I don't think anyone could have prepared me for the onslaught of people that have come out of the woodwork on this in my past and present. I said to my mother, you know, information didn't flow as freely back in the 60s as it does now. So I came into the office with my desk wallpapered and, you know, it photocopied on and put on everyone's desk in my office. So no hiding.
Huh. Caroline Sanchez Bernat, what kind of questions do they ask the contestants?
They ask three basic questions. They ask you, I'm trying to remember what all three of them were, but what is it about the subways that you like? Why do you think you would be a great Miss Subways? And what is it, I think something like, what is it about New York that makes it so great to be here?
Well, I guess you'd have to think for a while to answer those questions. We're talking with two of the four contestants in the current Ms. Subways contest, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, Caroline Sanchez Bernat, can I just ask, I understand from your profile that your relationship with the subway is also not just as a transit device, but you have another pursuit on the subways.
Yes. Well, I'm an actress, and about 3 years ago, a group of actors that had graduated all from the same acting school, we just wanted to work together, and we put together this project called Subway Brunch, and it was just essentially an eccentric man who wanted to eat on the trains all the time. And it became an elaborate process of improvisation. People would get in on one stop, the actor would exit on another stop. And we really learned a lot about subway culture and what it's like to perform in the actual train. We didn't invite an audience. It was really just for the passengers getting to point A to point B. And we did it for a while and really had some interesting experiences and some success to it. So when I saw the contest come along, you know, I was nudged by all my friends saying, oh, you're so Miss Subways, you should do it. You were doing that project for so long. Mm-hmm. And really on a whim, because I had done this project and because I'm a lifelong New Yorker, born and raised, I said, you know what, let me try it. And, you know, I really didn't think I would get called. And so it's been an interesting experience.
So what are your plans, Caroline Sanchez Bernard? What are your plans if you win this? I mean, do you have plans to improve the world, or, you know, what do you do with your crown? How do you change the world as Ms. Subways?
Well, you know, ever since this whole thing has come about, I've actually thought of this, because I was thinking, well, you know, it's a nice title, and I love the fact that it's retro and nostalgic and a throwback to the good old times in New York. But then I thought, you know, what's a title without substance? So I actually went ahead and contacted the Strap Hangers Association, which is an association in New York who have been fighting for commuter rights for quite a few years now, to some success, and asked them, you know, I would love to be involved in your whatever it is that you need to do with it, whether it be marches or passing out flyers, you know, if I get elected or if I don't get elected to be mm-hmm. Miss Subways, because I feel like if Miss Subways is a representative, well, then she better be fighting for commuter rights or doing something productive for the commuters in New York,
well,
the tri-state area.
Certainly they'll be stuck looking at your picture if that's the case.
Stuck is right.
Carrie Kent Smith, I ask you the same question. Do you have big plans if you win the crown?
Caroline, you put a little bit more thought into it than I have. I think that, you know, I will, you know, absolutely, you know, I've, you know, same with Caroline, you know, I love this city in any way in which I can, you know, help the subway system, you know, be better, or, you know, share ideas as well as be present, you know, during the appropriate situations. You know, I'm here to do that. I think, you know, we're going to see where this evolves. A lot of people haven't been familiar with this contest in many years, so it'll be interesting to see when we're, you know, when the winner is up in the subways and the whole revival, to see really what role that we can play, and, you know, eager and anxious and excited to, you know, see what lies ahead in this journey.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Carrie.
Caroline, I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Carrie Kent Smith and Caroline Sanchez Bernard are finalists in the Ms. Subways contest. You can see their profiles and those of the other two young women in the competition at the New York Post's website, nypost.com. But remember, no voting unless you're in the tri-state area. And we're still here talking with Randy Kennedy, who's the author of Subwayland: Adventures in the World Beneath New York. What do you think? Randy, did you have a chance to form an opinion on the candidates? Or are you voting in this?
I would like to vote. listening to them, I guess, I think the Miss Bernard seemed like she, you know, had some aspirations for actually helping the subway rider, so that's good.
Okay.
I guess that's the equivalent of saying, you know, when you're running for Miss America, that you're in favor of world peace.
Exactly. When we come back from a short break, we'll wrap up our discussion of the New York subway system, and we'll try to cover 79 years of New Yorker cartoons in 10 minutes. That's something you got to listen to. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're finishing our conversation about the centennial of the New York subway with Randy Kennedy, who wrote the Tunnel Vision column for the New York Times. And we're going to take a couple more of your calls. First, let's go to Hillary in Farmington, Michigan. Hillary, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a story.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
About 20 years ago, our family of five was visiting New York City. We were staying in the Times Square area, and we went down to, I can't remember the names of the stations, but we're going to go to Statue of Liberty. And we got down there, and we were kind of confused. The train came, and we weren't sure which one to get on. So we all got on, and somebody in the train said, oh, you're on the wrong one. We got off, except my 9-year-old daughter didn't make it before the doors closed. She's on the train, and we were off the train. And, of course, terror is raining on her face, and my husband's yelling at her, get off at the next stop, and we'll meet you there. And, you know, we're in total panic, so the next train comes, and we get to the next station, and there were three total strangers, wonderful New York people, who had gotten off the train with our daughter and waited until we got there. And I thought that was a very nice story about the quality of people in New York City.
That's very sweet. Hillary, thank you for that one.
Thank you.
Let me try one more. Let's go to Derek in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's your story?
Got a quick story that highlights how impatient New Yorkers are. New York, I think, is unique with express and local trains. The express trains skip stops to make trips faster. And normally they're on the same platform so that you can change trains when you need to. But at a Penn Station on the 1, 2, and 3 line, the 7th Avenue line, they're not on the same platform. So everyone ends up waiting for the local, but they're sort of looking around to see if the express is coming on the other track. And if it does, they race down the stairs, go up underneath the tracks, come up on the other side to quick catch on the train. I mean, God forbid that a New Yorker makes an unnecessary stop on a local train, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's a fun memory of mine when I grew up in New York.
Good one, Derek. Thanks very much. Take one more quick call. Let's go to Richard in New York City. Welcome to the program. Richard, are you there? No, Richard. Okay, so I get to tell my story real quickly. Last Thanksgiving, I was in New York visiting family for the holiday, and it was a nasty weather, and I took my children on the Astoria line because I'd never been on it before. It goes out to Astoria, Queens. And while we were the last two people on the train, very slow day, we're standing in the front, and the motorman opens the door and let my kids honk the horn on the train.
Oh, that's great.
Now, how often do you get to do that?
That's fantastic.
So do you think do people just go ride the trains for fun, Randy Kennedy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I spent several weeks writing a story about subway buffs. And, you know, they sort of range from sort of romantics to, you know, really obsessive subway buffs. And they, you know, do just ride the subways for fun, which you know, think is kind of an oxymoron, but they do. And I wrote a column about a guy who decided to ride the train sort of continuously on every line through every stop. He was a high school kid at that point, and so at some point the continuous part didn't work. He had to go home and have supper with his parents because they were worried that he was just going to disappear under there.
I thought you were going to say he was a high school kid when he started and was in college by the time he finished.
Well, it almost was that bad.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Randy Kennedy's new book is Subwayland: Adventures in the World Beneath New York. He joined us today from our New York bureau. NPR coverage of the subway's centennial continues throughout this month. Tune in to All Things Considered next week for stories about the subway in popular culture, new technology at work in the old system, and what it's like to be a conductor on the overnight shift.